In biology, it is not digital. It's not on or off. Biology is much more analog. It's much more graded. And the idea, just from first principles, that one moment we're alive and in the next instant we're dead, that everything is dead, makes no sense from even a strict materialist biological perspective. Makes no sense whatsoever. It's just not how biology works. It's more graded. Even within the brain, the idea that the whole brain dies all at once in an instant just seems to be inconsistent with first principles.
That moment of near disaster.
And with difficulty, kept my course.
It was for us the pleasure of discovering.
Richie, it's been, maybe 5 months since we first met in the jungles of Mexico?
Yes.
Wow, what a journey it's been. I gotta admit, that first meeting was pretty profound. We had a experience in trying to get our minds to a place where we were able to, I guess in some ways, get to the same meditative state that you've been studying your whole life, get to those gamma waves as you've written about. But I also, I don't know, do you remember back then there was this moment where I was kind of like, I'm going through a rough time right now with my friend passing away. And
that's
been a huge journey. I haven't talked about it a lot publicly, but I honestly almost didn't know if I could make it here today because she is finally at the very end of that journey. And it's been beautiful. It's been beautiful. But it's also brought me to a place where I feel like this conversation with you, and we'll get into that reason for why, but it was almost like it was meant to be here on this day. We're both scientists and it's hard to say like how the world works and how fate works. But last night, as hospice was telling me that we are within moments, I've read that the planets are all aligned in like this kind of celestial parade that NASA called it, right? Pretty wild. What? And also, right before I found out a year and a half ago that she, before she messaged me saying, look, I've got this terminal cancer diagnosis and this is what's about to happen. Somebody in the jungles of Chiapas handed me this book. The Tibetan book of the living and dying.
The book.
And I didn't know why. I was like, not exactly a book that I've ever really wanted to look at, or even because it's scary thinking about death, right? It's like, what? I was in the camp of people that sort of thought, okay, if you don't think about it, if you don't talk about it, then it won't happen to you somehow. Like, what? And yet my career, I've stared so much at death. I've spent so much time with bones and with mummies and with tombs and all the rituals of death that all of humanity has practiced to get to the place where we can accept our beyond. And then so the course of this last year, I've been reading this book and you've been in the top of my mind for many reasons because of a conversation that we had right at the very end of the first time we met. And I don't know, I don't want to push you too hard to say things that haven't been published yet, or to talk about things that you're not ready to talk about yet. But everything that I'm reading about in this book is about the process of the mind in the moment that we go through the bardo of dying. And studying that from a perspective of philosophy is one thing. And then now I'm seeing it right in front of me. I'm watching it happen right in front of me. And I'm trying to help her through the words that I'm reading here, like get to that meditative state. But you have spent a career, and I'll stop talking soon because this is a conversation, but you have spent a career looking at the mind in these states of meditation by request of the Dalai Lama himself. What advice can you give me in this moment where I'm probably within hours of helping my best friend pass away?
Yeah. Well, first, let me say that I'm honored to be in dialogue with you at this propitious moment, especially. I'm just feeling the rawness of it. I've had the blessing of being with both of my parents when they passed away. Each of them passed at home, and I was physically with them, with each of them. And that was a real blessing to be with them in that way. And yes, it's true. The Dalai Lama personally asked me to do what I'm doing. I really believe I'm on an assignment that I was given by the Dalai Lama really when I first met him for the first time in 1992, when he asked me why I couldn't use the tools of neuroscience that I was then using to study all the bad things like stress and anxiety and depression and adversity, and study kindness and compassion. And then, you know, a number of years later, there is a Tibetan practice that occurs right at the moment of death. And it is said to be only accessible to people who have had virtuous lives in some way. They may have been practitioners, but they could also be, you know, complete lay people just based on their history, their karma, so to speak. And they go into a state which is said to be tukdam. And tukdam in Tibetan means clear light. And it is when it's at the moment of death when a Western physician would call us dead. The heart has stopped beating. The breathing has ceased. The senses are shut down. And the individual in tukdam is said to be in this clear light state where there is the preservation of some residual quality of awareness. And this can last anywhere from minutes to hours to days to even weeks. And His Holiness recognized that this was a really important period to study and a practice to study because for so many different reasons, really. But one of them is because according to our Western understanding, a person is dead at that point. And there's nothing. And yet, according to the Tibetan tradition, there is some residual awareness. And if there's that residual awareness, then it means that our accounts of how things work, so to speak, are woefully inadequate, to put it mildly. And so we began to study this. And in fact, you actually are asking this question at the right time because just, I think, maybe 2 days ago, a new manuscript that we have written about tukdam has just been accepted in a scientific journal.
Oh, congratulations. But and this means that you are actually using EEGs or looking at the mind and the brain in that moment?
Well, we've actually published already a paper on EEG where we found nothing. So we published it. It was a non-finding. And we found that when we put EEG electrodes on practitioners' heads, we found what Western scientists would expect us to find, which is a flat line. There was no detectable EEG activity. In this new paper, what we did is we recruited two forensic experts who were experts in bodily decomposition. And this is, you know, they're forensic pathologists. This is what they do. And often these are the kind of people who in crime cases are called in to say, you know, when the death occurred based on the decomposition of the body and
process of dissolving the rigor mortis, all the things, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so these are really super experts in that field. And we convinced them that this was a worthy exploration. They're willing to explore with us. And what this new paper is about is the lack of bodily decomposition in the Tukdam practitioners during the period of Tukdam. And in fact, in the traditional Tibetan context, when the body begins to decompose, that is the sign that Tukdam has ended. But in one of these cases, the individual was in Tukdam for, I think it was 26 days, 26 days in tropical India.
And you've witnessed this, or this is an established thing that the forensic scientists were able to see and study, or is this more based?
So what we do is we these cases that we published, I did not personally witness, but we have a research team in India who did witness this, and we video all of this. So this is all on video. And the forensic pathologists made their findings based on the video evidence. And in the video, we also use color calibration so that we do this quite rigorously, and we also carefully control the illumination. We measure the temperature of the room. You know, we do all that kind of stuff. And so those are the data that these forensic experts had access to.
Yeah, the way you described it to me in the jungle is that a meditator will enter into the final bardo of dying, the final phase, as they're entering into that clear light, and what I've been reading about is this memory that's been written down and passed down over the centuries that talks about this ground luminosity that emerges in your mind, in your natural mind, and how you step into that, right? But what you described to me as well was that they'll be sitting with monks chanting around them, and they'll sit for up to 10 days after the heart stopped, and then all of a sudden collapse and decay in a day.
Right.
Is that right?
And I should say yes. And I should say that I've witnessed one of these cases personally. I was maybe 3 feet away from the practitioner, and he died in a seated posture. And if I didn't know he was dead, I would have thought that he's just meditating along. It was a room that was, there were about 12 people in the room, and they were monks, and they were all chanting. It was a room that was not very large, but a medium-sized room, comfortably held the 12 people, but it would be a room where if there are 20 people, it would be a lot of people in the room. So it was a pretty small room. We were all seated on meditation cushions. And if I didn't know he was dead, I would have thought he was meditating. I mean, he wasn't chanting, but, he looked like everyone else. And I was seated very close to him, and his body the skin looked very fresh. Wow. There was certainly, and I saw him on two occasions. His Tukdam lasted for 8 days, and I saw him on day 3 and day 7.
And there was no decay at day 7?
No.
Wow.
No, and then on day 8, massive decay very rapidly, and that was the end.
Rainbow lights all around, right? Like, for me, this is so interesting because I'm actually in a moment where I'm helping design the ritual, Well, I am designing. I'm the main support person for Jamie Satellite, and I'm her power of attorney, so I have to make all the calls, right? And it's like traditionally there's a playbook, you know, cultures have a process. This is what you do. And this is, you know, but so many more people nowadays go through life without facing the thought of death and live a much more agnostic lifestyle without the rituals built in that might be preparing us through our lives for the ritual of death, the way that Tibetan Buddhism is. So now I'm in this moment where I'm like, well, how do I design this? Both in the immediate death and then the aftermath and then the funeral and the processing of the body. And my last guest on this podcast was my friend Wade Davis. Do you know Wade by any chance?
I do know Wade, yeah. In fact, I was hanging out with him very recently in Ojai, Ojai, California.
Oh, yeah. He's a good friend. Yeah. He's a longtime friend. What a guy. You know, but he has very interesting experiences at the realm and edge of death and bringing people back. I spent time at the banks of Varanasi, you know, where the Ganga resides. And, you know, there's like a whole process of trying to burn your bodies in Varanasi if you can within a certain amount of time before you have to re-enter into another cycle of rebirth in Hinduism, right? So there's so many different versions of how to face the weeks and the months after death that have been built around culture. From your perspective as a neuroscientist who works at the edge between science and philosophy and spirituality, what's like, should we, like, you know, so many Western traditions are like, well, okay, move the body as soon as you can out into a freezer and then wait for it. And then, you know, then there's a cremation process and it's all kind of happening, right? But in this book, it's like, critically, don't touch the body at all for as long as you can after the death, right? It's very different. It's never been told to me before. And now I'm figuring it out. What, as a neuroscientist, is actually the move?
Well, a few things to share, and it's a great question. And I can tell you from my understanding and my experience, first of all, let me share that there is some hard-nosed neuroscientific evidence in animals, believe it or not, that clearly, unequivocally demonstrate that there is brain activity after the heart stops beating, and after breathing stops, and the brain activity has been found to persist in animals for at least 45 minutes after what we would classically consider the animal to be dead. So one lesson from this is, and you really, for me, it's like going back to first principles. Biology is not silicon. But in biology, it is not digital. It's not on or off. Biology is much more analog. It's much more graded. And the idea, just from first principles, that one moment we're alive and in the next instant we're dead, that everything is dead, makes no sense from even a strict materialist biological perspective. Makes no sense whatsoever. Mm. It's just not how biology works. It's more graded. And so even within the brain, the idea that the whole brain dies all at once in an instant just seems to be inconsistent with first principles. And the animal studies confirm that. Now, we've never seen in any of the Tukdam work that we've done, we've never been able to get to a body within the first hour. You know, we can't, you know, recruit practitioners for this until they pass away. And so
because a lot of people know that they're dying, right? Like,
that's
my
true.
Friend, she's been dying for a year and a half. And now we're like, I've been planning around this moment. And if she had known, I don't know if she would want that, because there's so much said in the philosophy that your mind has to detach in this harmonious way from your physical body and enter into whatever's next.
So there's some things to say about that. First, you're absolutely right. And we're actually beginning a new phase of our work in India where we are recruiting older practitioners who are nearing death. And there are many advantages to that. We're going to be able to record their brain activity while they're still alive and see if there are any predictors that actually predict who will go into tukdam, because only a small percentage of practitioners go into tukdam. And I asked the Dalai Lama point blank, I said, Your Holiness, can you predict who will go into tukdam? And he thought about it for a moment and he said, I don't think so. And so, you know, that's an interesting question. The second thing is that ethically, we believe it's more wholesome ethically for us because we're going to be able to get their consent while they're still alive, rather than having their attendants give consent after they pass away. Mm-hmm. That's how we're doing it now, up until now.
You suspect that you'll see in a larger data set, you'll see activity of the brain.
If we're able to look at it within the first couple of hours, yes, based on what we now know from the animal studies. The other thing that I think is this raises incredibly important pragmatic and ethical issues, for example, for organ donation. Transplant surgeons harvest the organs within seconds after the heart stops beating. Mm-hmm. And what this perspective illustrates is that, well, there may be stuff going on during that period. And I've would want my body to be preserved for some period of time.
In a state of lying without nobody or without anybody touching you, right? I mean, I've got a friend who I've been asking all my friends for advice on what they think is going to happen to them after they die, because I'm like, well, how do we plan this? And I have one friend who's already planned an air-chilled, hermetically sealed bubble around his body. He's already written it down in his will, and he doesn't want to be touched for 10 days after his death. And it seems like that's the same. It's getting at the same idea that there's something happening in our.
Yeah, although the touching is an interesting issue. So early on in this work, His Holiness the Dalai Lama asked me to co-convene a meeting with him, where he invited monk attendants who witnessed tukdams from their teachers from all over the world, but these are all Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, but from all over the world. And he brought 15 monks to Dharamsala, India for this meeting, all of whom were the attendants at a tukdam. And he began this meeting by saying, I want to go around the room and I want each of you to report exactly what you saw, what you observed, and I don't want any Buddhist philosophy. I want you to just tell me what you saw, and no Buddhism.
What came?
It was amazing, because one of the most consistent things that was reported is that touching the body actually didn't disrupt the tukdam.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That makes it way easier, you know, because it's like you gotta clean and you know, get everything.
Let me give you an example. So one practitioner in the south of India died in a hospital and went into tukdam. And the attendants around him decided that he shouldn't remain in tukdam in the hospital. They should bring him back to the monastery. Mm. And it was a 4-hour drive from the hospital to the monastery. You know, you've been in India. You know what it's like.
Well, four-hour drive in the streets of Varanasi would feel like you're in the greatest flood of life you've ever experienced, you know?
Exactly. So they took him in a car They drove him back to the monastery, and his tukdom continued for another 6 days.
Wow. Okay. So in this process of tukdom, which has been recorded both from video and you've witnessed it yourself, you're an established, famed, and acclaimed scientist, Harvard trained, and you see this thing happen. And you, like, how do you explain the body not decomposing? That's one question. But the second thing is what are you looking for by showing brain activity? Are we looking for evidence of, because I understand what your other work was about. I kind of get, and I know it's very simplified, but the idea that in the reality that we're neuroplastic through meditation, we can reach these states where we exist in a higher plane of gamma, of what you call the, or what's been described as the gamma frequency. Is that right? Which is like the
gamma oscillations.
The gamma oscillations.
And you know, by the way, it's in the animal studies when they recorded brain activity from the animals. These were, in one case, cats, and in another case, rodents. They saw gamma oscillations. That was what was induced post-death.
Really? Because gamma oscillations, for those who might be listening who've never heard this before, can you explain them in layman terms? Because they're pretty, they're like the, it's like the wonder brain, right? It's like the, or not the wonder, it's like the aha, like the connection thing. But as I understand it, what you're observing... Yeah, go on. You explain it. You're going to do better than I am.
Right, Albert. So, yeah, when you have a flash of an insight, you know, suddenly something just becomes apparent to you. We normal people like us would have a burst of gamma oscillations, but they're typically really short, typically less than 1 second. You know, these momentary insights, they're like little bursts.
The aha moment is a moment.
The aha moment, right? So what we've found and published in long-term meditators when they're alive is when they show these gamma oscillations for long durations of time when they're meditating. They also have much higher prevalence of these gamma oscillations during a non-meditating state, just during a quote ordinary state. So at baseline, they're different. They show these gamma oscillations at baseline.
So in the brain, there's all these different oscillation levels. There's, and then the alpha level, is that right? That's my like working brain. Is that right? That's like me sort of, was that the beta?
Well, which one is that one? Yeah, it's alpha is typically seen when you are not actively engaged in cognitive effort. When you maybe have your eyes closed, you're resting, you're a little drowsy.
Next one up is beta.
And beta is seen during cognitive activity. So if I ask you to multiply 36 by 17 in your mind mentally, you would show beta oscillations.
Well, what I loved in your book, the Altered Traits one, was you gave an example of three words and said, I think it was like crab, something, I forget what it was. And then there was one word that would unify all those words, and it was apple. Right. And you're like, what you're feeling right now in that aha moment.
Exactly.
Is the gamma. Exactly.
Right.
It took me a little while longer than most people would, because I was like, wait, what? App? Crab, apple crab. I couldn't figure it out, but now I get it. I'm like, okay, but in meditators, you're feeling this a lot more than in normal states. And what you also described was, and I'm not sure if I got it right, but was that other parts of the mind that aren't generally associated with this meditative state all get into that same resonant oscillation. Is that right?
Exactly. They're highly synchronized. Exactly. And the meditators who are showing this often report that they have a kind of panoramic awareness. You know, they just are sensing everything, everything around them, not just visual, but all the senses are totally open, including feeling their body, feeling their mind. So everything is open and just all integrated together.
So there's this the reason that my friend Jamie and I, she goes by Shadowlight, became so close was through music. We spent the most of our friendship playing music together, and in a way that wasn't ever scripted or, you know, annotated. It was all just flow state music. It's very trippy stuff, really weird kind of spacey music. And she's this violinist, and she plays this unbelievable sound of resonance. And she used to always tell me, this sound is coming from the source. And, you know, whenever we got to a flow state where we completely lost our sense of bodies, yet, you know, and yet our fingers still kind of functioned miraculously, we could feel the other person in our minds in a way that the fingers were playing together in a dance that I didn't even know was happening. It was just all intuitive. Were we both in that gamma realm, in that altered state, even though it wasn't about like an insight, but rather it felt like we were in a completely altered state?
Yeah, I would say very likely. But and even one other thing, which is that likely your gamma oscillations and Jamie's gamma oscillations were themselves synchronized.
Yeah, we actually tried to measure that. So we felt this was happening. And my friend Ramesh Rao, who's the director of the Qualcomm Institute at UCSD, was studying heart rate variability among meditators and looking for coherence among multiple meditators. So he gave me this heart rate variability sensor, and we wore it, and we actually did find moments of coherence that we matched to the timeline of our music, where we were like, cool. That was it.
That's cool. I love that.
Yeah, it was just experimental, you know? But now that she's dying, and you know, and we're dealing with pain. A lot of pain comes from dying. In fact, In the Tibetan book of the Living and Dying, it describes the bardo of dying as the painful bardo. How do you get practically? What should I be saying to somebody as they're dying to get into a meditative state of awe in the gamma state, which is what I assume you're saying that we should try to get to try to, in the words of this, it's like what happens at the moment of death is that you want to be in as meditative a state as possible so you can accept your transference of consciousness without all the karmas that you're holding on to in your current life. Yet you're battling against the most furious pain you've ever felt in your life. So how do you get the mind to let go of that pain and enter into that meditative state?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really great, deep, difficult question. And I would say first, I think it's important to give up the goal. There's not trying to get into any state to do anything, to be anything other than what you are. That's one really important piece. And it's really, you know, one of the ways I often phrase this is when we meditate, it's an invitation to transition from a mode of doing to a mode of simply being. And to not fight with our mind. That's really important. So that's one thing. And part of not fighting with our mind is, as difficult as it sounds, is somehow really not trying to distract oneself or run away from the pain, but to dive into the fire. And to go right into it. And so, you know, one of the things that's often done in meditation retreats is when you sit for long hours, day in and day out, it becomes physically painful. Now, I'm sure that the pain that Jamie is going through is more intense. But this is a little facsimile of it. And, you know, it varies among people. For some people, I think it does get pretty intense. And
yours was your knee, right? I remember reading about your knee. Sorry to be really, really painful.
Yeah, really painful. And, you know, there's a certain style of practice. I don't practice in this style any longer, but it was helpful at the very beginning of my journey, where in this kind of meditation retreat, after a certain number of days, you take a vow that during a meditation session, you're not going to move, no matter what.
What if you got to go pee? Well,
it's, you know, they're only 1 hour sessions, so it's not, you know.
That's good. It's my worst nightmare. You know, having to go to the bathroom but not being able to because somebody said you had to sit there. It's awful.
But, you know, when you're sitting for 16 hours a day, it's, you know, it for me, it was super painful. Just, you know, the body really begins to rebel. And you know, and then you take a vow of not moving, and that means not shifting your leg. You know, it doesn't mean not getting up. It means literally not moving. So, there you basically have no choice, but other than to accept the pain and, to really dive into it. And then something happens. Something happens where you begin to see, wow, the pain is like lots of differentiated stuff. There's tingling, there's heat, there's pressure. It's very granular.
You're observing it, but you're observing it without emotion, and it's getting tighter. It's getting more granular, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, at some point also, it's no longer I am in pain. It's just, you know, it's just these sensations that are happening. It's awareness. And at that point, you know, there's kind of a breakthrough. Yes, it doesn't mean the pain has gone away. The pain is still there, but your relationship to it is radically transformed.
I had a similar experience when they cut my leg off, and I was on so much, you know, painkillers and everything in the days immediately following. And at some point, you can't, you know, you're clinching, right? You're like, you're clinching in pain. And at some point, I did exactly what you said, which was like, you can no longer clinch, and you just got to lean into it and embrace it, almost succumb to it, face it, lean into the fire. And only then does it sort of dissolve away. I'm reminded of another story you're reminding me of is when I was in the early stages of parenthood, you know, the sound of a crying baby is, you know, it's like evolutionarily designed to cause distress, right? In us. And then there's the terrible twos. I don't know if you had kids, but there's
both older now, but I went through it.
Yeah, the terrible twos and the terrible threes. And then it's like, wait, when does this end? It's going to four.
And the terrible twos.
Yeah. Exactly. When there was this scientist that described, I'm listening to some Radiolab thing about it, and he was describing the arc of a tantrum and observing the tantrum, not from within it, but from the side, and actually showing its decibel level as it rises, peaks, and then descends down like this. What you just described to me sounds so much like that. It's like, okay, our bodies are having these illusionary tantrums. And if we see it like that, then it's not like we're emotionally invested in it as much.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's this question that's at the very crux of the conversation though, which is, we can observe things physically. We can see things, you know, and then there's this philosophy of what's like, what's beyond, what is that all related to, you know? Cause I, like I said, I've spent my career in the realm of the rituals of death, whether, you know, it's in an ancient pyramid or, with mummies on the side of a cliff. And now I'm right there with this person as I'm listening to her breath and I'm looking at her eyes, and she starts describing things that are so universal in her whispers, you know, very small things, right? Like, she's having conversations with people who have long passed, and they're right next to her over the course of the last year, right? Like, or as we got closer to this day today, there is this kind of description she gave in a moment of lucidity just a couple days ago, where she said, "There's so much magic," and then she talked about, I said, "What does it feel like?" And she said, "It feels like glitter." What do you think? I mean, wow. You know, I know it's hard to ask somebody to take off their neuroscientist scientific mind and put on their, you know, other mind, but like, just as a friend, what do you think? Like, what do you think happens? Where do you think this other realm is? You know, what is this other realm? Is it, you know, are we, is there, what's beyond? Because it's the one thing we've all had to face through all of time and all of humanity.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I hear stuff like that, it's, for me, it's a practice of humility, because it reminds me of how little we actually know. You know, I've spent 40 years being a neuroscientist and, you know, doing all this work and publishing all these papers. And at the end of the day, you know, we really know so little. And these kinds of experiences are, I think, powerful and healthy reminders of that. And, you know, the mainstream scientific community, you know, the dominant response to something like this is dismissive. It really is.
So you're there and you're facing it, and then there's no choice but to be in it. Like, it's a universal experience. Whether you dismiss it or not, you're going to have it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, what for me, I don't have a well-developed theory. What I do have is a conviction that the world that I've been taught in the traditional academy is very incomplete. And that there are realms and aspects of reality that we in, you know, the mainstream understanding just have absolutely no friggin' clue about. And you know, I'm open to it. I'm very open to it, because there are many people whose minds and hearts I deeply trust, who I think are utterly sane, you know, saner than most other people, like the Dalai Lama, who, you know, have shared these kinds of experiences with me.
And the Dalai Lama, has he talked to you about his own memories of his own reincarnations?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to go into anything beyond what you're comfortable talking about, but does he remember the bardo of Dharma, am I saying it right? Dharmata and the bardo of becoming?
Well, what I would say is that, first of all, the current Dalai Lama is the 14th Dalai Lama. And he has very intense memories of some of the Dalai Lamas. Not all of them. And he shared with me memories of lives of some of them. He's particularly connected to the fifth Dalai Lama. And, you know, he really quite extraordinary access to certain features of their lives that, you know, have never been recorded in any kind of text that anyone knows of.
What do you think he's searching for in asking you to look at this very specific but fundamental moment in this life, in our cycles? You know, because it is as far as I understand it, the moment of death is one of the most powerful moments in the Tibetan belief system of Buddhism, is the most powerful moment in which you can shed your karmas and move towards a state of enlightenment. But what is he looking for in the activity of the mind and the brain and in this scientific approach using modern tools? Why is he searching in that realm?
I think he is searching for a particular reason, and that is that this is an area where the mind and the brain separate, and that potentially is studyable. You know, he sometimes jokingly ridicules modern science for thinking that the mind is just what the brain does. And in fact, you know, if you look at there's a department at MIT called the Department of Brain and Cognitive Science, which is essentially their psychology department, but it's mostly neuroscience. And, you know, it's an amazing department. And there are a lot of friends of mine who are there. And, you know, it's there are some really extraordinary people there. And I have deep respect for them. Having said all that, it says somewhere on their website, in sort of telling about what the work that they do, they say something like, the mind is what the brain does.
Seems very limited.
Very limited. And even from a strictly materialist perspective, you know, we know that there are 200 million neurons in the gut. Mm. And we know that the gut has all this bidirectional communication with the brain. And, you know, to think that your mind is just in your brain is like so, in my view, so unbelievably narrow. And for a bunch of incredibly smart people to say something like that is, you know, it just underscores how pervasive this kind of materialist view is. And so I think the Dalai Lama is looking for opportunities to poke holes in the materialist conception of reality.
You know, I was holding her phone yesterday, looking at old photos that she had from my house, because I looked at the map and I was like, okay, these are the photos that she's taken of our friendship together. And I'm like, you know, what's going to happen to these photos, right? I got to get them off this phone. Otherwise, it's going to live in the cloud for a certain period of time. And the cloud's going to, like, after she stops paying her cloud bills, then what will happen to this memory bank, the digital memory, the information memory of her life on Earth? And it was so, I had this kind of existential feeling of like, well, that's the continuation of the information. That's like maybe that'd be like the functional brain, you know? But it's her essence that is maybe the mind, like the resonant stuff that's not in those photos. And it continues on after her death. Like, I was thinking about it. It's like her living memory is in this cloud database of all her photos and voice recordings and emails and messages. But all the voice recordings of all the music we've played together is locked in this memory in the cloud. And it kind of continues on, but her essence is, it's like pervasive now. It's everywhere. It's not anymore in this physical thing. I also had this memory where I met with, when I lost my leg, I had severe phantom pain. And I worked with a friend now, but at the time, you know, he was retired. But you know Rama, V.S. Ramachandran?
I know Rama, yeah. Yeah, he's a great guy.
He also had the Center for Brain and Cognition, you know, but I walked into his lab one time and it was so cool. You know, dinosaur bones and brains and jars and stuff. And he said, where does the body end and the mind begin? You know, and, I don't know, right? I mean, I guess I do know when I start reading about this, I'm thinking about the idea that there's two states of mind. Maybe there's the mind that's in my chest and maybe, you know, or in my being. And then there's this other natural mind that is this effervescent feeling that there's some kind of universal love in the universe, which I've certainly felt in radical moments of awe, right?
Yeah.
I sat underneath the auroras the other day, and when the northern lights came and my friends and I were in Iceland, and I was looking up at the auroras, and I had that like, oh man, this is the universe just telling us it's going to be okay, right? And that feeling is this other thing that we all exist within.
Yeah, I love that, and I've felt that too. And you know, I think it invites the kind of conjecture that there may be some kind of energy that we haven't yet discovered that is the substrate of this kind of awareness that extends beyond our bodies, that somehow we connect with. And, you know, I think it's clear from talking to any modern physicist that, you know, current physical accounts of the universe are certainly incomplete, and there's, you know, it's not all wrapped up.
It's not all wrapped up. But you, of anybody, may have the insights as to what happens in the physical body in that moment at the edge. And so, I guess, last question. I have two questions before I run back to the vortex, is what I've been calling it. One is, do you have a plan for your process? Like, are you going to be cremated? Or is that the way to go? Like, what, like, from a spiritual understanding of the mind, like, what, because I got to make all these decisions now in very real time. I'm not trying to tell you to plan or aftermath, but I'm just asking for your advice. What would be, because there's all these different traditions. I've studied them all from an archaeological adventuring perspective and, you know, anthropology perspective, but not from a neuroscientist perspective. So, yeah.
Well, I'll share a few things. First, the first thing to say is that I'm not an expert. And there are many people who know much more about this than I do. Then I'll also share that in the case of Thukdam that I witnessed, it actually was a case, believe it or not, here in Wisconsin. It was the passing of Geshe Sopa. Geshe Sopa was a Tibetan Buddhist monk who is a very high lama, who was actually the first professor of Tibetan Buddhist studies at any American university. And he was on the faculty here at the University of Wisconsin. And it was the first time that Wisconsin ever granted a full professorship to someone who did not have a PhD. He just had a Geshe degree from a monastery in Tibet. And a Geshe degree is kind of the equivalent of a PhD, but from a monastery. And it's the kind of, it's what the Dalai Lama has. The Dalai Lama has a Geshe degree. And Geshe Sopa was the Dalai Lama's principal tutor in Tibet before he escaped. He was extremely close to the Dalai Lama, and Geshe Sopa has a monastery that's 15 miles outside of Madison. And that's where he resided. It was a small monastery, still exists. So Geshe Sopa passed away about 8 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. And at the time he passed away, you know, he went into Thukdam immediately, and the monks at the Deer Park Monastery, which is what it's called, called me, and they said that you're not legally allowed to keep a dead body in a home beyond a certain point, and he's in Thukdam. What do they do? So they asked me if I would write a letter immediately on university letterhead to the head of the State Department of Health, explaining what Thukdam is and seeking an exception. The other thing is, they wanted to, when Thukdam ended, they wanted to cremate the body on the site, but it's illegal in Wisconsin to cremate a body except at a crematorium, you know, at a funeral place. And they wanted to do it right on the site. So I crafted a letter on both of these topics, sent it to the head of the Department of Health, you know, on official letterhead, and it was approved based on the letter.
That's amazing. So if I want to have like a Viking burial for myself or something, and it's illegal to burn this ship with my body on it in the future or something like that, all I got to do is get you to write a letter for me and then it's done. I want a pyramid, you know, can we make that happen?
A pyramid would be great. But in terms of my own plans, you know, there are a few things that I have put into place. One, and this is pertains to one issue that you brought up, Albert, and that is that unless I explicitly request it, no narcotics, no drugs, nothing.
That's been hard here. She's been requesting it, but it's extremely painful, and she's in extreme pain. And so we've been waiting for her to request at all times.
Yeah,
and brutal to watch, but you know, but the agency is a big deal. Like her sovereignty has been a central part of this journey.
Yeah. And the other thing I've requested is that my body not be touched until it starts to decompose.
But you said that it was okay to touch the body.
Not touching it in the sense of not cremating it.
All right. There's a process that I just read about called aquamation that Desmond Tutu did for himself, where you kind of dissolve in alkaline water and all you're left with is that. But do you think, I mean, I don't know. I'm like literally having to make these decisions now.
Yeah, so. I don't know. You know, in the Tibetan tradition, they also do sky burials. Do you know what a sky burial is?
Yeah. Genghis Khan may have done a sky burial, you know. I don't think we can get a letterhead that will let that happen. I mean, you can try if you want to send me a letter. We could, But it's beautiful. This process has been, people think of it, I thought of it as sad. I thought of it as scary when somebody handed me this book before I knew what it was preparing me for. And then a week later, I get the message saying, here's the ride. We're going on a ride now. This journey. And now that I've gone through the journey, maybe for others who might've been listening to this or you know, whatever, it's the way that I've described it to my friends has been that it's been beautiful. It's been profound and beautiful and joyful. The other day, when she was walking about still standing, she was like, this has been so fun. You know, it's like, this has been so fun because it's philosophical, it's deep, it's thoughtful, but it's also liberating. And I guess I'm grateful to, you know, they say in this book that helping someone die is the greatest honor you can serve them. And I've been so grateful for that journey. And I really appreciate your advice.
Well, it's beautiful to hear you describe it. And also I can feel the love and support. This dear friend of yours, I think is very fortunate to have you as in this role at this time.
Jamie Shadowlight. She is a musician of extraordinary beauty, playing sounds from her violin that she's described as being from the source, which it truly feels like. And she's touched so many people in her lives. I mean, the whole community has really been there with her. It's just not just me, but this incredible outpouring of love, which has been also a beautiful thing to see. The final question I have for you is kind of, I don't know, maybe it's more technical. It's not as profound, but maybe it is profound, is that if we don't think of death as the end and we think of it as a continuum of a cycle, and there's this phase between which if it's like, okay, here's our life, Bardo, here's our death, here's our afterlife, and we come back and here's our rebirth. Then we have these two states where we have the consciousness in the ordinary mind over here, and then you have this other existence of consciousness. Now, you've studied a lot about the exit of consciousness, and you don't have to answer this because I know it gets really political really quickly, but the entrance of consciousness is the natural other realm to be thinking about, right?
Yeah, right. And there, Albert, I really have no idea. Really, I just, it's like, whoa.
It's beautiful to watch when your kids are born and when they develop, but it's also like, whoa, what is this? It's magic, right?
It is. It really is.
Yeah. There's always hope, you know? That's the thing that I've felt for these things, that it doesn't feel like the end. It feels like one step of liberation in this beautiful continuum. Well, Richie, I hope to see you again soon. But me this too. Has been
this is so great to connect.
Yeah, strangely, in this moment, where I think that the moment for me that's relevant to this conversation is truly upon me, and the planets in this exact day are aligned in what NASA called the parade of planets. And the fact that you and I were thrown together in the jungles to have that conversation and then now have this, which was scheduled months ago, and all of a sudden it lands on this day or this week, whenever it happens. But, you know, thank you for helping me understand the moment and bring whatever I was meant to get from this conversation back to the vortex that I had to now.
Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing this story. It's really so important and powerful.
Okay, Richie. We'll talk soon.
Very good.